Now, as you recall, at the last taping session, we were discussing 2 Timothy 3, verses 16 and 17, in which we talked about the sacred scriptures, or unique writings, as we might translate those words, or the only one of their kind writings, which are able to give the wisdom that leads to salvation. That's the first thing the Bible does. It tells us how a person can be saved from sin. And of course, that's a very vital interest that we have in the scriptures, evangelism of those who do not know the way of life. It tells us that good news that Jesus Christ came into the world to save sinners, that he came into the world to die on the cross in the place of guilty sinners, bearing their penalty, taking upon himself the wrath of God that was due them, that through faith in him, as verse 15 says, we might have everlasting life. And of course, that good news that he died for the sins of those who trust in him also is given to us with real assurance by the resurrection, the certainty of it by the resurrection, where God stamps his stamp of approval upon that death. Now, the scriptures tell us something else, and it's what they tell us in verses 16 and 17 that is so vital for all of counseling. They are useful, as we said last time, usually translated profitable, but the word simply means useful. And the trouble is that so often in our use of the scriptures, we have learned in Sunday school and in various other contexts to use the scriptures in a manner which is anything but useful to us for our daily living. We've learned how many books there are in the Bible, and that's useful. But then we've learned how many chapters in each book. That's a little bit marginal. And then some people have gone so far as to learn how many words in each chapter. That, I think, is extremely doubtful in use. And then some people have learned what is the middle word in each chapter or in the Bible or in each book and so on. That is certainly useless kinds of material. Well, now, it usually doesn't go that far, but there's that sort of mentality and that spirit among much of the learning that we have done in the scriptures. We have learned how to catalog the kings, to know where all of the events took place, and to recite again what the events were in the Old Testament and what took place in the Gospels and so on. Now, all this has its place so that we gather a great deal of basic data, and these data may be used later on, but the trouble is we have only learned to use those basic data about stories and facts and so on as material to file away for quick retrieval for the next Bible quiz. What we need to do and what we need to learn is how to use the Bible to deal with the problems that arise on Thursday, not just the questions that are asked on Sunday in Sunday school. And you see, we haven't taught people how to use their Bibles in a practical way to change their lives. They know facts about the Bible, they learn data from the Bible, and that's essential. But they do not know how to use the facts and the data to meet the problems that meet them day by day. They know how to move from the Bible out into life, but they don't know how to move from life into the Bible to find and retrieve God's useful words for those problems that they meet in daily life. Now, it's true that in this short series of tapes, we won't be able to handle that along with everything else that we're trying to do. But I'm simply laying something of a groundwork and a foundation here for this tremendous need, and each person listening is going to have to struggle with it on his own. I've been looking personally for a book along this line, and I haven't found one, and if somebody doesn't publish one before I get to it, I guess I'm going to have to work on something of this sort. At least I have something like some primitive notes that may develop in that direction, but I would be very happy if somebody listening to this tape were to do it first and send me your work, and we'll certainly use it in our context. Now, we want to go on beyond noting that the scriptures were intended to be useful, to notice what use they may be put to. The scriptures are useful, verse 16 says, for teaching, for reproof, for correction, and for training in righteousness. Those are the four things that the scriptures will do in counseling. Those are the four factors necessary for biblical change. Those are the four steps in a program of change. Those are the four things, and they all can be done by means of using the scriptures. Those are the four things that every man needs when he thinks about change in his life. The counselor needs it, and the counselee needs it. First of all, teaching. The scriptures teach us what God requires. They teach us what love toward God and love toward our neighbor consists in. They teach us all that we need to know about our problems, God's basic solutions, and the ways and means of moving from the one to the other. The scriptures are the standard of faith and practice. They teach us what God says. But now, after the scriptures set the standard, lay out the program, help us to develop proper ways and means out of those basic principles, they move to the second point. They reprove, although that word is an improvement upon some of the previous terms that have been used, it still does not go far enough. The Greek term here is a legal word. It comes right out of the Greek law courts. I don't know how many persons listening have ever taken Greek, but if you ever took any college Greek, you were probably subjected to the works of Lysias, who was a logographer, or as we call them nowadays, a speechwriter. When the Greeks in Athens developed their democracy, they also developed a court system. And they were very proud of that court system, and they used it. Everybody hailed his brother and neighbor and sister and uncle and cousin up to the courts just about every week or so, it seems. At any rate, you were always likely to be hailed into court, and, as Peter puts it in one of his letters, you had to be ready to give a defense. Each one had to give his own personal defense. And the interesting thing here is that many people, of course, if they had to give a defense in court, just didn't know how to do it. They didn't know how to speak publicly. They would have a hard time of it. So they would hire a logographer or a speechwriter to write their defense for them. And one of the most famous of those speechwriters was Lysias, whose speeches became so famous and were collected by Greek professors and put together in a book in order to persecute second-year and third-year Greek students. Well, as you read these studies of Lysias, these orations of his about the fig tree and all that sort of thing, they would have all kinds of battles over who owned the fig tree. And one word continually appears again and again and again and again and again in those legal writings. This word, the second word in verse 16, reproof. What it means is more than just to reprove someone, but it means to take somebody to the court and to so pursue your case against him that he has a pronouncement of judgment made against him. It is to so press the case against him that he is, in the final upshot, convicted of the crime. That's the second thing the scriptures do for us. They show us what God requires first, then they show us quite convincingly that we have failed to meet those requirements. That's necessary, you see, in a process of change, to know the standard, to see what the yardstick is, and then to recognize that all have sinned and come short of the standard, have come short of the glory of God, that we don't measure up, as Romans 3:23 says. So, the second thing that the scriptures do is that they knock us flat on our faces. They show us our sin. They show us our rebellion against God and our failure to acknowledge and to keep his commandments. But then the scriptures do a third thing. They don't leave us there in the dust groveling. As we continue to pursue them, beaten and bruised and battered perhaps, they come along
and see us on our faces and do what the third word literally says, not simply correct, but stand up straight again, is what that word means. It does mean to correct, but perhaps even a little more. They pick us up, put us on our feet, and head us in the right direction. We've seen what God requires. We've discovered how we've failed. And now the scriptures show us how to deal with our sin and failure before God. How to get out of the mess. How to find not only forgiveness and cleansing through confession, but also how to get started afresh in a new way. But the problem is that many people, and we're going to spend some time on another tape really going into this issue because it's so vital, many people stop right there with those three things that the scriptures do. And so there's no real sticking, lasting, continuing change that is effected. And this is where much of the change, failure, occurs by forgetting that there is a fourth factor. And that is training in righteousness. That means disciplined, structured training. It means so working at the new way that God requires that our lives are transformed. It means so pursuing the new that the old is replaced by it. We'll come back to that, as I said, in a later tape. So four things that the scriptures do. They teach us what God requires and provides and promises. They convict us of our failures to meet the requirements. They pick us up and show us how to get out of the mess and get faced in the right direction again. And then they help us to stay out of those problems and to walk in a new way that God provides for us. So the scriptures then are able, according to verse 16, to do the four things that are essential to producing vital change that sticks. Now, we'll unpack those words a little bit later on in more detail. But notice verse 17. They do this in order that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. The man of God here is particularly, in Paul's writings, aimed at the minister. For example, in 1 Timothy 6:1, Timothy, as a minister, is addressed as a man of God. It's a term that's picked up out of 1 Kings and other Old Testament passages, but if you're interested in referring to this to see what a man of God really is, according to the scriptures, you might turn to 1 Kings 17, 18, and 24, where an explanation of that occurs. I'll not go into it on this tape. But it certainly means here that the minister who does this as a full-time calling from God, or the layman who does this as a part-time task as he ministers also, and the Bible, of course, is explicitly clear that every believer in Jesus Christ ought to be ministering his word to someone else, using his gifts. And indeed, every Christian is called to counsel in verses like Colossians 3:16 or Romans 15:14. From which I took the title for a book that I wrote called Competent to Counsel, and in which I discussed in that book the layman's place. I'll not go into these matters in much detail here to try to establish that. You can read about it if you care to do so. But notice here that what is said is that the man of God, whether he's the full-time minister or whether he is the person ministering the word of God in part-time, he is someone ministering the Bible to another person. And the scriptures give him all the information, all the data, all the resources necessary to produce change, this fourfold process of change, in order to make him adequate and thoroughly equip him for every work to which he is called. One of the works to which he is called, clearly, is to counsel other people, help effect change in their lives, in value, and in behavior, and in attitude. Now, the words that Paul uses here are most enlightening in verse 17. The word that he uses is a nautical term. When he speaks about being fully equipped, it literally means to be thoroughly rigged out as a ship would be. in anticipation of any exigency that might be encountered on the voyage. Here is the ship's owner, thinking through all of the possible problems that might arise during that particular trip. And he tries to anticipate what kinds of gear, what kinds of resources, what kinds of equipment ought to be put on board. That's the thought in this Greek term. It's a very good, picturesque term to describe what the Bible does for us. Now, I don't know if Paul were alive today, I'm almost certain, I can't be sure, but I'm almost certain that he would have used an aeronautical term. Because Paul would have certainly used the best means of getting around in our day. At any rate, let me explain this word and try to give you a fix on it that will help you to understand it and make it stick so that you can remember what he's talking about here, what he's saying that the Bible does for the person who counsels. I remember way back in the days when the airlines were flying DC-3s, and you sat there on the tail, sort of leaning back in your seat, and the stewardess would climb up the aisles and get to the front of the plane. And remembered one time on an Allegheny Airlines flight, and I'm not a salesman for Allegheny Airlines, but we might as well give credit to whom credit is due. We were sitting there ready to take, before taking off, when a very ample woman came down a very narrow aisle and tried to squeeze herself into the seat directly opposite mine on the other side of the aisle. There was no way. Just no way. She tucked a little on the right and squeezed a little on the left, pulled a little somewhere else, but nothing would happen. Those narrow seats in those old DC-3s were really rough to handle. Well, the stewardess, sizing up her plight, came down the aisle and reached across her and removed the armrest from between her and the seat next to her, and she flowed over into the other seat. Well, the first exigency had been encountered and handled, but then came the seatbelt. You can imagine what might have occurred had Allegheny Airlines not anticipated such problems beforehand. Well, she tried, and it wasn't even halfway there. She tried on the right and tried on the left with more tucking and more straining and more stretching and more pulling and pushing, but there was no hope. And the stewardess, out of one corner of her eye, took this situation in and then disappeared into the front of the plane. Seconds later, she reappeared with an extension belt which she snapped into both sides. Allegheny Airlines, equipped for every good work. Well, that's what the word means. You get the thrust now, and maybe that little image will help it to stick. That's the idea. The man of God is thoroughly furnished for every exigency, every problem, everything that might arise in the work to which God has called him. No pastor, no preacher need be embarrassed by using his Bible alone in dealing with people who are having personal problems, in dealing with people who are struggling with this question of how to love God and how to love their neighbors as themselves. Neither need the layman who, armed with his Bible and a great deal of trepidation, to try to help another person. All the resources, all that is necessary, all that you need to thoroughly furnish you for every work is there. Now, very frequently at this point, people raise objections and questions. They, of course, raise them at other points too, but this is where Christians even raise objections from time to time. Their objections run something like this, usually. They say, well, now, just one little moment, please. You're saying that the Bible has all that is necessary in the way of resources and information and principles and data and all these things to affect the changes that are needed in people's lives. Isn't that going just a bit too far? Well, I don't believe it's going too far, because I just read you where I got that source of thinking from this book itself, which even supplies me information about that point. But let's discuss that for just a moment. The reason why people raise this question is, as they put it, you don't use the Bible as a textbook for engineering. You don't use the Bible as a textbook for mathematics. You don't use the Bible as a textbook for X, Y, or Z. Name your discipline here. Why, then, would you claim that the Bible is a full and sufficient textbook for counseling, for affecting changes in values and attitudes and behavior in people's lives? The answer is, of course, that the Bible was never intended to be a textbook for electrical engineering or even for some other kind of engineering, chemical or whatever. That the Bible was never intended to be a textbook for mathematics. That it was never intended to be a textbook for almost any discipline you might think of. But the Bible clearly was intended to be a textbook for living. It was intended to be a textbook to tell us how to love God with all of our heart, mind, body, soul, and strength, and how to love our neighbor as ourselves. And you know, that's just what it does to perfection. That's just what it does by divine breathing out to keep it free from error and fill it with the information that is necessary for this purpose. After all, the people who come to us in our counseling center in Pennsylvania do not come saying, now you see here, I've got this here problem with my automobile, or I've got this here problem with my house, or I've got this here problem with my table and chairs and furniture in the house. They come and they talk about their problems with persons, either with themselves or with God or with their neighbors or with their associates at work or with their family. They have problems with persons. And that's what counseling is dealing with. Problems that people themselves have with other people and with God, with persons. And so, the Bible is an adequate and thoroughly sufficient text for telling us to how to deal with our problems that have to do with persons. You see, when the Bible says that we may be adequate and thoroughly equipped for every good work, it means that. It really means that. And that's where every counselor comes up against it. That's where every counselor has to face the real decision. That's where every counselor finally has to take his stand on one side of a line or another. You see, there are many Christian counselors, many ministers, many laymen, who don't quite want to go that far. They want to take the Bible plus. They want to take the Bible plus this philosophy or that. But you can't do that. Because the Bible, we're told here, is the complete handbook. And when you add philosophies, when you add material, I'm not talking about the filling out of the Bible principles, of course, in the application in many areas of life, but when you add principles, when you add presuppositions from other theories, they don't fit. You can't hold together what God says and what sinful men say, and come up with a system that is coherent and that works. When God has given a book, a textbook, you need to have the kind of certain faith to accept it. Here is the drawing of the line. We read about completion in other places. This book is said to be able to give us a complete set of resources for the work of counseling as well as other works to which the minister and the Christian layman are called in ministering this book. Now, there have been a lot of other books that have claimed to be complete in the history of the world. Being a fisherman, I think naturally of Isaac Walton's The Complete, C-O-M-P-L-E-A-T, The Complete Angler. Oh, it's a quaint little book. But that's about all that it is, as every fisherman knows. Very interesting reading, but not a word about monofilament or open-face reels or anything else. It's just not a complete book on angling. And you know, for those of you who know what I'm talking about, I've even found a word missing from Young's Concordance. There is no complete book in this world that really attempts to do the job that it claims to do. Only one. That's the Bible. But it really does do that job. The problem is, you see, we haven't believed that, and so we've walked right past the mine with all of its gems and all of its resources and piddled around with all kinds of other things. And that's why we've been ineffective. And that's why, as the psychologists and psychiatrists themselves are saying today, we just don't have the answers. We're right back where we were when we started. The whole field is in disarray. There are hundreds of ideas on the market. A new one comes off of the press every other day. You can take Gestalt therapy or primal scream. You can be a radical therapist or a reality therapist. You can have group therapy or psychotherapy, and there are many varieties of the latter. There's neo-Freudianism, old Freudianism, and who knows what will be the neo-Freudianism. There's TA, transactional analysis. There's, and you know how the list goes, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of viewpoints on the market. If you think that it is the psychologist or the psychiatrist who enters into counseling apart from the scriptures, if you think that it is he who has the answers as he sits in his plush office with the rug up to his knees, lined on all sides with books from the masters, if you think that it's he who has the answers, then you haven't talked very long or very hard with him. You haven't read what he and his fellows who are really in the know are saying, for example, like Fuller Torrey's book about the death of psychiatry. You aren't really conversant if you don't know that there is much disarray in that field. As a matter of fact, every time he opens his mouth, every time that he makes a suggestion or gives a word of advice, every time that he fails to do so, there is somebody from some corner of his shelves silently to the counselee, but very audibly to the counselor saying, "Come off of it. Don't tell me you're going that route." Whereas on some other shelf, there's somebody happily applauding. Then 5 minutes later, the fellow who applauded before is saying, "Oh, now you're off the track." And somebody else is saying, "All right, you're getting a little warmer now." He doesn't really have a standard. He doesn't really know what man's problems at base are. He doesn't really have either a temporal or ultimate answer to man's problems. And he doesn't really have a text in which he can put the kind of full confidence that we can place in the scriptures. Do not believe that you lack something when you use the scriptures as your standard for counseling. Now I want to move to some of those people who need hope that we were talking about last time for the remainder of this tape, and just sort of skim some of the problems and show how quickly hope can be given. Then we'll get into some of the ways and means that this can occur in depth later on. Those who have tried and failed need hope. Many people, as we've said, have put their hopes in the wrong thing and so have lost hope. Now, those people who have tried and failed may have tried the right thing in the wrong way, or the wrong thing even in the right way, and have failed. Let's take, for example, Christians who have tried the wrong thing. We have a personal data inventory that we use with people whom we counsel. These materials and others are all available in what is called a starter packet that you can read about in the Christian Counselor's Manual, a book that deals with these matters that are on this tape. A personal data inventory that we use with people whom we counsel. These materials and others are all available in what is called a starter packet that you can read about in the Christian Counselor's Manual, a book that deals with these matters that are on this tape in more detail. In this personal data inventory, or as we lovingly call it the PDI, we have three fundamental questions that come toward the end, which each counselee fills in. And the first question is, what is your problem? The second question is, what have you done about it? And the third question is, what would you like us to do about it? Now, we'll come back to those questions at a later point. But right now, listen to the second one again. What have you done about it? Now, I've got a group of people here with me to sort of spur me on in making these tapes, and they're a very responsive group, and I'm sure they will not fail me. But I'm going to throw out a question to them to see if they, like every other audience that I've ever asked this question to, come up with the same answer. If they don't, there's something wrong with them. All right. Now, what do you think more Christians write in than one word, than any other word? Let me ask the question again. What have you done about your problem? What do you think they write in more frequently than any other word?
Pray.
Pray. Right. Pray. That is the wrong answer in almost every instance. Christians think that that's the right answer, but almost always that is the wrong answer. Now, it's not wrong in and of itself. There is certainly nothing wrong with prayer when it is genuine Christian prayer. But when it stops with prayer, then there's something wrong. If you will check the scriptures, rarely does a recommendation or a command to pray not also fall within a context in which the person is told to do something. The prayer is the springboard for biblical action. The prayer is the base from which the person goes out to fulfill the commandments of God. It is what conditions all that he does, asking God to bless it and have his will done. But prayer, in and of itself, is rarely the answer, per se. In certain extraordinary circumstances, that might be so. But certainly with these people who come and write in prayed, who think that they've done the right thing, this is not the answer. So often we have to say to them, Nella, suppose you prayed the Lord's Prayer. Give us this day our daily bread. That may mean, you know, meet all of our needs today, but it certainly includes your food and your bread. Now, once you've prayed that prayer, what do? Go outside and sit under an apple tree and wait for a loaf to float out of the sky on a parachute? Go to bed and wait for somebody to ring the doorbell and deliver the loaf? No, the counselee says, no, of course not. Somewhere over in Thessalonians or someplace, doesn't God say something about if you don't work, you shouldn't eat? Yeah, that's right. So the Bible not only tells us to pray for our daily bread, it tells us to work for it. But we should not work without praying, and we should not pray without working. The two must be coupled. There's no real faith in prayer if we don't move out on that faith to do what the Word of God says to do about it. And we wrongly move out if we don't pray first, if we don't ask God to bless our action. You see, this is the point that so many Christians need to recognize, that there is not a sufficient dealing with a problem when they have prayed about it if God has told them to do something as a result of that prayer. So the biblical directive, along with prayer, is often essential. Many people who have attempted to solve problems have attempted to solve problems by talking. They were told that talking to others would help them, that counseling was essentially a process of talking. And if they talked through their problem, that they would get insights into it and find solutions to it, and that talk would be the real basis for solving those problems. Now, all counselors talk, or at least all counselees talk within counseling context. Some counselors don't say much. They only listen to counselees talk. But I want to say that while talk is a very vital part of counseling, it can be the most dangerous factor there is when there is only talk in counseling. Now, if you have a simple problem that you know the answers to anyway, and a little discussion with a friend might help you to more clearly see the dimensions of the problem and come to answers that you already knew but had forgotten, of course, talk of that sort can be helpful, but we're talking about people who have tried all that. and who are far beyond that point and who just don't have the answers. And to think that by talking alone that the answers and the resources will come is a sad mistake. You see, when a counselee goes to a counselor who only listens, and the counselee does all the talking, all he's doing is getting insight into his problem. He rarely gets any insight into the solution to it. He goes and he tells his problem again, and maybe he sees new avenues of the problem. When he went, it was the size of a quarter. Now it's the size of a half dollar when he comes away. But he really hasn't gotten any solutions. And particularly when a man goes to a Christian who says that he has a divine book, a book from God that is filled with resources from God that are beyond our ability to cough up on our own. And he finds that that man, minister or Christian ministering that word, doesn't really give him advice and suggestions and commandments and requirements and information from that book. When he goes away destitute in despair. Because rightly or wrongly, here's the way most counselees who come to Christians for counseling read it. I'm going to find out what God has to say. And if the counselor was silent, the counselee assumes God is silent. And so he goes away in despair, saying, even God doesn't have an answer to my problem. But it may have been there all the time in that closed book inside the drawer of the counselor's desk, when it should have been out on the desk, opened up, and ministered to that man. So talk only that doesn't deal with talking through the problem to God's solution is inadequate. Those who are fearful and worried need hope. Fear can paralyze and immobilize. The answers to fear and worry can be given and given quite concretely from the Word of God. For example, just to show what initially can be said in a very brief manner to a counselee, Matthew 6:34 gives a very concrete answer to worry. Do not be worried about tomorrow. Tomorrow will take care of itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own. A man comes and he's all disturbed about tomorrow. The counselor who knows his Bible brings hope through a verse like that. The counselee may say, look, I know you've read this verse and it says don't worry. You've read Philippians 4, I know that also, it says don't worry. I know that worry is sin, but that's just my problem. How do I turn off this emotion? How do I stop it? I've looked around for buttons and switches and dials on me and I can't find any. I can't turn off emotions quite that readily, push a button and off it goes. And now I'm not only worried about the problem I have, but now that I read the Bible that tells me not to worry, I'm worried about worrying. What do I do now? And the counselor says you've got the whole wrong focus on the situation. This verse doesn't tell you to turn off your emotion. This verse doesn't tell you to turn off your concern. It tells you to turn it around, refocus it. It's not turning off concern. It's focusing concern on the right day. The verse says, don't worry about tomorrow. Don't be concerned about tomorrow. But it says, each day has enough problems of its own to handle. You be concerned about those. You see, concern turns into worry when it's focused on the wrong day. When it's focused on tomorrow. Tomorrow isn't here. You can't get a handle on tomorrow. There's no way to concretely deal with tomorrow. And so you wonder and you toss in your mind and your ideas this way or that. What will tomorrow be like? But God hasn't given us tomorrow. You sketch out the best you can what you think you have to do for tomorrow and leave that in God's hands to blue pencil, as James says. But you can work on today. And if every man has turned all of his energies on today, he's not worrying. You see, worry is the antithesis of work. And a lot of people who worry are lazy people. Jesus said in Matthew 25 to that servant who hid his money in the ground and who said, Lord, I was afraid. He said, you wicked, lazy servant. Laziness and fear often are coupled in this manner. So there's a concrete answer to give hope immediately to that man. The depressed, older persons, suicidal persons, persons with life-shattering experience like grief or breakdowns, to all these people, there are ways of giving hope. We shall look at these in future tapes. But remember, as we close this section, the great hope of all is the hope of the gospel about which Paul speaks in Colossians 1:3 and verse 23. And that hope, as well as all the rest of the hope, comes from the scriptures. Remember, Romans 15:4. And from the scriptures that were written by God, the source of all hope, Romans 15:13. Those verses, perhaps, can form the basis for a discussion of what we have said in this tape.
And now for your homework assignment. First, using either a case in which you recently were involved, or some case mentioned in the Christian Counselor's casebook, isolate several particular problems and work these through the four factors that represent the four steps of biblical change that are mentioned in 2 Timothy 3:16. 2. Consider and discuss the place of talk in counseling, especially in conjunction with the biblical concept of love.